be young, isn't it? I want to talk this morning about Lebanon. As you know, I'd intend to do so last week, but I was leveled by a virus. And I'd like to begin by reminding you that when the guns finally were silenced in September, and when the PLO took its noisy and well-televised exit from Beirut, our own government announced as its immediate aim a policy to remove all foreign forces from Lebanese territory. Now, there are, of course, three foreign forces in the Lebanon. In the south, the Israelis. In the east, in the area known as the Bekaa Valley, which comprises about half of all of Lebanon, the Syrians. And operating within the Syrian lines and also in the north around Tripoli and Latakia, a force of some 10 to 20,000 PLO regulars. All of the negotiations which the United States pushed were between Israel and the formal government in Beirut. The Israelis originally demanded, as you'll recall, that there be a peace treaty between Lebanon and Israel, and that there be some kind of guarantee of the southern area, that it would be free of infiltration by terrorists and not again be a base from which an army could launch an attack on northern Israel. The Lebanese, after a long and protracted debate over procedural matters, indicated that they were not at all willing to enter into any kind of peace negotiation. They claimed that this would forever cut them off from the Arab world, which is their natural market. And as if to emphasize this point, the Saudi Arabian government, which was presumably working on our side, announced that it would embargo all goods that were originating in the Lebanon. And that Lebanon also announced that it would not permit joint patrols or the return of Major Haddad, whose Christian militia forces had been patrolling the southern part of Lebanon before the summer war. And that's where the negotiations have largely remained. And as you know, our own Secretary of State is in the Middle East now in a form of shuttle diplomacy, trying to get some kind of final agreement. What has been assumed by our government, and I think innocently and naively, is that if an agreement is achieved between the Lebanese government in Beirut and the Israelis, the Syrians and the PLO will simply pack up their tents and leave. And I frankly don't see any reason why they should. The PLO simply has no other place to go. If it returns these forces to Syria, they will come under the Syrian National Army. There's already a full PLO division within that army, but they will have lost their independence. And no other Arab state permits the PLO to act with any degree of independence on its own territory. As for the Syrians, I think it's important to recognize that Syria has never recognized Lebanon as an independent government. The Syrians consider Lebanon to be part of Syria. And indeed, historically, they have good claim. For never in history has the Lebanon been an independent state, except in our century. And throughout history, it has either been part of an empire ruling out of Syria or a province of the Syrian, a part of the province of Syria, whether this was organized by Rome or by one of the caliphates or by the Byzantine Empire or by the Ottoman Turks. Moreover, in terms of cost, the Syrians have no reason to want to leave the Lebanon. It's a profitable occupation for them, unlike most occupations. The Bekaa Valley is one of the great harvest areas of hashish in the world. And the selling of this harvest brings needed hard currency to the Syrian government, allowing them to pay for some of the arms which the Russian government has given them through the years and is now giving to them in very large quantities and at very great cost. Syria is not an oil-rich Arab country, and it's a very radical Arab country whose basic ties are with the Soviet Union. It has absolutely no reason to cooperate in a policy which the United States government, Washington, conceives to be in our interest. And frankly, I fail to see why, given even an Israeli-Lebanese agreement for the removal of Israeli forces, the Syrians would do anything but perhaps a modest thinning out of their forces. I can't see why they would want to leave the Bekaa Valley, which is the natural western frontier of this plateau area, which is Syria. The Bekaa Valley abuts the mountains of Lebanon and provides them a natural defense frontier. Moreover, they will have every excuse in the world, given their language and their ideology, not to withdraw, because they will say, we will not go any further until the last vestiges of Zionist Western imperialism have been removed from the Lebanon, by which they will mean any kind of security agreement which Israel has negotiated. And Israel, of course, will not move out of Lebanon without such agreements and will not remain out of Lebanon if these agreements are not, in fact, enforced. The United States policy is one which has a large degree of acceptability in our own country. We don't like military occupations. We assume that a country should be independent. We've tended to go along with Washington because it seemed to be doing the right thing for once. But I'd like to ask a different question of you this morning, and that is whether, in fact, the Lebanon can be an independent country, whether, in fact, we are talking about independence in any kind of constructive sense, or whether or not the policy which we are adopting will not simply precipitate the Lebanon back into the kind of civil strife which tore it apart between 1975 and 1978, one or another of the 20 major militias, which in effect are the governments of the Lebanon, will fight with each other over turf and taxes and import and custom duties and all the perquisites of a national power. I would remind you that between 1975 and 1978, 50,000 Lebanese and foreigners were killed in that civil war. And by the end of the war, no one was sure who was fighting with anyone else. The Lebanon had, in fact, become a series of quasi-independent feudal states, each governed by one or another ethnic religious force, each supported by the taxes and the customs that that force was able to devise and to take, and often by monies that was coming in from outside governments. During the 1960s and 70s, over $300 million a year were sent by Algeria and Libya and Syria and Iraq, other Saudi Arabia, other of the Arab states, to one or another of these forces. And during the 1960s and 1970s, these various militias, each governing a particular piece of territory, were able to receive in taxes and customs duties $50 for every $5 which the so-called legitimate government of the Lebanon was able to collect. The ports of the Lebanon, outside of a small part of the port of Beirut, are controlled each by a different militia, each by a different government. They collect the customs. Those militias engage in massive smuggling, which is another source of major income. Each of them is well armed, far better armed than the so-called formal Lebanese army. And there is no reason to believe that the formal Lebanese army and the nominal Lebanese government in which we're putting so much trust is able to effectively govern the Lebanon. What is it governing today? a small piece of Beirut, and nothing more. Its army was supposedly responsible for the outside perimeter of security at our own embassy, and we saw the great results. I don't know how many of you noticed a very short piece that appeared on the television a few nights ago, which showed the Falange, the militia of the president that belongs to the party which supports the president of the formal government of Lebanon, Gamayel, turning over to the formal government the man who had detonated the bomb which had killed Bashir Gamayel, the brother of the present president of the Lebanon a few months ago, and a number of other terrorists who had engaged in various activities inimical to the Falange. It was not the police force or the army of the Lebanon which had discovered, uncovered, and arrested these men, but one of the militias. None of the officials of the Lebanese government can act independently of the will of these 20 or so major military forces. I titled this talk, Lebanon to Be or Not to Be. It might very well have been entitled, The Lebanon Which Has Never Been. We think of Lebanon as lines on a map, as a nation like any other nation. But the word Lebanon is not the designation of a nation or of a national culture. It comes from the Hebrew word lavan, white. In the Bible, it's always called halavanon, which means the same as when we speak of the mountains, the white mountains. It's a description of a piece of land which is largely mountainous, the mountains of which are snow-capped in the winter, and therefore quite unusual in that part of the world. The archaeologists have uncovered settlements in Lebanon dating back 10,000 years. The best known of the ancient settlers of Lebanon were the Phoenicians, those that great seafaring and marauding tribe who in the first millennium before the Common Era sent their barks across the Mediterranean, founded Carthage, Gibraltar, most of the ports along the Spanish coast, and in fact controlled most of the Mediterranean trade. But if one looks carefully at the Phoenicians, one discovers an interesting fact. They represent not a unified national empire, but a set of feudal city-states, Tyre, Sidon, Beirut, Avnet, each of which was always at war with the other. There was no such thing as a sense of national or cultural identity shared between them. And one of the leading students of Phoenician history has written that at no time did the Phoenicians develop any sense of national unity or national consciousness. And I'm afraid that this is the truth about those who have lived in Lebanon then and ever since. The Lebanon is really the mountains. And the mountains of the Lebanon have always been very much like the mountains of Tennessee and Kentucky. Places to which families went who wanted to flee from the city, flee from civilization, flee from pressures of one kind or another, and who then in one mountain fastness or another zealously guarded their turf, their little valley, their little hillock against all intruders. You've heard a great deal about the Maronite Christians. This is the party of Amin Gamaliel, the president of the Lebanon. The militia of the Maronite Christians, the Falange, is probably the largest Christian militia in the country. They're about 23%, they represent about 23% of the people of the Lebanon. The Maronites go back to the 7th century. They go back to a Christian heresy. Christianity during the first millennium of our era was troubled by one great issue of theology. Jesus is in their testament both a man and a God. And a great deal of blood and a great deal of trouble was developed over the relationship between the nature of the man and the nature of the God. Was Jesus first a man who then became a God? Was he a God at birth? who somehow had a human career, all these very complicated theological questions led to heresy after heresy during the first millennium, heresy being defined simply as that group at a church synod which lacked the majority of the votes. But once you were declared a heretic, your life was in peril. And so the heretics, particularly in the East, would flee from the cities. And a group of heretics called the Monothelites, developed in the 7th century in Byzantine, the Byzantine world, who were eager to devise some way to bridge the fact that Jesus was both man and God, and the fact that the church had already said that Jesus was separate in nature when he was man from the nature he had when he was God, which removed mortality from the God. And they declared that, yes, he was separate in his nature between his state as man and his state as God, but he shared a single will. And for that, they were declared heretic, and they were persecuted, and they were run out of Constantinople, and they fled to the mountains of the Lebanon, where in time they became the people we call the Maronite Christians. And then about 4 or 5 centuries later, there came to these mountains 2 other largest groups, now not Christian heretics, but Muslim heretics. The first, Shiites. We've become familiar with the Shiites because of Khomeini in Iran. The Shiites are a group of Muslims who argue that the legitimate caliph was Ali, the nephew of Muhammad, and that there was a legitimate line of authority down for 11 caliphs, until finally that authority in a war was disrupted, and there is now what they call a hidden imam, a hidden messiah, a hidden caliph who will come back in time, and when he does, Islam will be returned to the true way. They look on the majority, the Sunnite majority, as people who follow false leadership. They are heretics in their eyes. Therefore, the kind of struggle that we see between Shiite and Sunnite in the Middle East. In any case, the Shiites fled to the mountains. And shortly thereafter, another group of Muslim heretics called the Druze fled to the mountains. The Druze originated in Egypt. They originated in the 11th century. Egypt at that time was ruled by a group called the Fatimids. And one of the caliphs called Al-Hakim, the wise one, was a man who seems to have been a bit paranoid, a little bit, we would say, meshuggah. But he had visions. He was a wild man, he was vicious and violent, but he had visions of Allah, visions of God. And he disappeared. He didn't die in any normal way, he simply disappeared. Probably was poisoned and thrown to the Nile. But he was disappeared, and those who believed in him, who followed him, said that he is in heaven, he is the hidden imam, and when he returns, he will do what the Messiah must do, renew the world, and all will be returned to the state that it should be. And so the Druze and the Shiites and the Maronites, the Monothelites, came to the mountains, carved out bits of territory in the mountains, and lived there, sometimes warring with one another, but relatively managing to keep the rest of the world out of their mountains. The Lebanon then had 2 parts to it, a small coastal area which was governed by whatever major empire governed the Middle East, the Seljuks or the Mamluks or the Ottoman Turks, and the mountains, where the empire preferred not to go, where by and large they left the mountaineering people to their own devices. But then in the 16th and 17th century, as colonial interests in Europe began to impinge upon the Middle East, the French decided that the Lebanese area represented a potential source of commerce and profit, and they proclaimed themselves the defenders of the Christians of this area. France is, of course, a Catholic, largely Catholic nation, and they decided to defend the Catholic groups in the area. That is, they built for them St. Joseph's, a great university. They brought many of the sons of the sheikhs to Paris, taught them about commerce and industry, helped them to establish businesses, to be their factors in the Middle East. And the Maronites, under French tutelage, became a much more powerful group than they had ever had before. And this, of course, unsettled this kind of vague balance of power which had existed in the mountains. And in 1860 and 1861, the Druze rose up in rebellion and massacred thousands of the Maronites. and the French and other European powers felt it necessary to intervene. And a very interesting arrangement was inaugurated called the Règlement Ordinaire, the Ordinary Rules. The very French title suggests the role that France had in establishing these rules. Nominally, the Ottoman Turks controlled all of the Middle East, but clearly they had no effective control in the mountains. And so largely under French guidance, the mountains became essentially a separate area, and they were given there for domestic purposes of their own government, led by a Maronite Christian prime minister with a council of 12 who had veto power over his decisions, comprised largely of the other religious minorities who had escaped into the mountains, the Shiites and the Druze. And from 1860 to the First World War, this area of the mountains was essentially an area, a law unto itself. It managed its own business fairly well, and except for an occasional Hatfield and McCoy kind of quarrel, revenge, blood revenge, the mountains were fairly passive. At the end of the First World War, when the West began to carve up the Turkish Empire, the French made a critical and, I believe, fatal decision. They were eager to gain the mandate over this area, but they were not willing simply to gain a mandate over the coastal area or over the mountains, and they bound these two very distinct areas together. They carved out at San Remo, where the mandates of the League of Nations were established, an area which comprised all that's within the present boundaries of the Lebanon. These are arbitrary lines drawn by Europeans on a map in Italy, having nothing to do with the realities of the ethnic, political, social, religious realities, the power realities in the area. And against the advice of a number of the experts in their own foreign office, the French brought under a single rule the lowlands, which are almost entirely Muslim, which are almost entirely, in terms of economics, involved with the Muslim heartland in Syria, in Iraq to the east. That's where their interests are. And in numbers equal about to the mountain people. And the mountain people, who want only to be free of the other Muslims, free of this majority from which they had fled long since and which they fear greatly. Beirut became the capital. Between the two world wars, the French were able to enforce a kind of peace, but at great cost in terms of military presence. And then when the French found during the Second World War they could no longer maintain their colonial empire, they freed the Lebanon, that is all of the Lebanon, both the mountain area, which is so different from the plains area, and the plains area. And in 1943, Lebanon proclaimed a national pact. Major parties came together in Beirut, and they proclaimed a national pact, and this pact, which is very brief, suggests the problems which have destroyed the ability of Lebanon to achieve any peace ever since. Because the Maronites, the Christians, those peoples whose attitudes and interests are to the West, renounce their dependence upon the West, Lebanon announces that it will establish itself with an Arab presence and Arab interests. And now, because of population growth, because of the pressures of the new resurgence of nationalism among Arabs throughout that part of the world, the mountain peoples, the peoples who wanted to escape these pressures, will increasingly be forced under the power, the numbers, the population numbers of the larger majority. This 1943 pact has three brief paragraphs. Lebanon is to be a completely independent sovereign state. The Christians to forgo seeking protection or attempting to bring the country under foreign control or influence. In return, the Muslims will forgo making any attempt to bring about any political union with Syria or any other Arab union. Lebanon is a country with an Arab face and language and a part of the Arab world, having, however, a special character. Lebanon is to cooperate with all Arab states and to become a member of the Arab family, provided the Arab states recognize its independence and sovereignty within the existing boundaries. Now, this kind of unstable arrangement, which clearly shows two people in one country, at least two people in one country, with very diverging interests, lies at the basis of the fragile national unity which the French tried to create in the Lebanon in the 20th century. And what happened? In the 1950s, with the resurgence of Arab nationalism, which we associate with General Nasser, groups of people from the lowlands particularly, who had not had some of the advantages that the French had given to other groups, began to demand union with the Arab world, that all attempts to speak of Lebanon as having a special history and a special destiny be abandoned. You recall in 1957, Syria and Egypt combined into what was then called the United Arab Republic, and millions of dollars were sent into some of the clandestine armies of the Lebanon to encourage a revolt against Beirut. It was this time that President Frangieh wrote to General Eisenhower requesting the Marines, and in May of 1958, we sent in 10,000 Marines into the Lebanon in order to protect its, quote, independence, end of quote. We succeeded in doing so, temporarily. But when the Marines were pulled out, the central government was no stronger than it had been before, and the militias continued to receive money and arms from their various sponsors and sources. And in 1975, civil war broke out, vicious, cruel, brother against brother, interest against interest, rich against poor, Western-oriented against Eastern-oriented, Christian against Muslim, sometimes Muslim against Muslim, Christian against Christian. We have a feeling because of the television coverage of last summer that the devastation of the Lebanon was unparalleled. The casualties between 1975 and 1978 are on the order of 20 times the casualties that Lebanon suffered last summer during the Israeli PLO war. Now, what is Lebanon today? Is there, in fact, a central government in the Lebanon that could be effective? There is not. There is a government which has all the appurtenances of government. It sits in the United Nations. It has consulates and embassies in this country or that around the world. It's treated by governments as if it is a government. But if government be defined in terms of effective power, I assure you that the government of the Lebanon has less effective power than the police force of Beechwood or Shaker Heights or of Pepper Pike. It controls an area of only a few square miles. It would not control all of its own capital were it not for the multinational force, which is there in place. And one of the reasons that there is such difficulty in making arrangements for the guarantees that Israel demands on its northern border is that there is no way that the Lebanese government can effectively guarantee security of any such area at this time or at any conceivable time in the future. For the truth is that once people are armed, they do not willingly or easily give those arms up. And particularly when you're in a part of the world where the blood feuds are old and ancient and vicious, within 3 days of the ceasefire between the PLO, the Syrians, and the Israelis, the Druze and the Christians in the mountains of the Lebanon were fighting with one another again, and Israelis were losing their lives trying to separate the two forces. When I ask myself the question, who would really gain from the removal of foreign forces from the Lebanon, I come, unfortunately, to this answer. Israel seems to have on the surface a great deal to gain. The occupation of Lebanon is costly, both in terms of dollars and in terms of manpower. Well over 100 Israelis have lost their lives during this 8 months of the occupation. Israel would be quite happy if guarantees were forthcoming to return within her borders. The United States, on the surface of it, has something to gain from the withdrawal of foreign forces because it would show that we are not a paper tiger. That we, in fact, can twist arms and enforce something that we think is in our own interest in the Middle East. But what is the Lebanon to gain? Civil war. What is the Lebanon to gain? Can the few thousand troops of the multinational force enforce peace throughout the Lebanon? In 1975, you recall, there was an Arab force sent in to be a peace force into the Lebanon. Not 5,000 or 8,000 troops, but 30,000 troops. And they quickly withdrew into small enclaves in Tripoli and in Beirut and admitted that they could not control the rest of the country. If there is ever to be the possibility of some kind of peace within the Lebanon, it's going to take years and years of living together, a willingness to recognize the value of a central government. It's going to take the forgetting of thousands of years of hate, and it will not come about overnight. Indeed, I doubt that it will come about because the self-interest of each of these groups is in maintaining its own independence, its own taxing force, its own source of revenues. And if the United States or the Soviet Union were to say, well, we won't sponsor any more our friends in that part of the world, do you think that Libya or Algeria or Iraq or Iran will stop sponsoring theirs? Lebanon was an artificial creation from the beginning. In the mountains, there was an artificial agreement as to the powers which would be divided between the sheikhs, the feudal lords. Under the National Pact of 1943, there was an artificial division. A Maronite Christian was always to be the president of Iran, of the Lebanon. A Sunnite Muslim was always to be the prime minister, and a Shiite Muslim was always to be the head of the parliament. And there was always to be a certain 654 representation on all government bureaus. That's artificial. And as populations change, as the birth rate changes, as one group wants more of the action, more of power, more positions, more patronage, obviously there's going to be restlessness and anger, and when one is armed, there will be bloodshed. I wish the United States government had not rushed into this program, which requires the elimination of all foreign forces from the Lebanon, because I'd like to speak a bit of heresy this morning myself. And that is that in many ways, the occupation of the Lebanon by foreign forces is one of the best things that could happen to the Lebanon. The Israelis in the south can, in fact, control the south to the degree that they can protect their own borders. The Syrians in the east have a natural interest in the Bekaa Valley. The supply lines, the communication lines, the people of the Bekaa Valley are one with the people of Syria. The Lebanese are really the people of the mountains. And they have a national interest in keeping themselves free from being submerged by the tidal wave of Arab nationalism, which is sweeping that part of the world. They are the minorities. They are the persecuted. If you will, they are the Jews of the Arab world. And they know that they are exposed unless they have an army of their own. They have no chance. They will be destroyed. Because the Arab world has no patience with minorities unless they are totally subservient to their own ideologies. If the foreign forces had been allowed to remain in the Lebanon in time, some form of cantonment, like Switzerland, might have emerged. And if this kind of division between the national interests of the Syrians in the east, of the Israelis in the south, and of the Lebanese themselves in the mountains had been allowed to develop, and various kinds of arrangements, such as the Middle East is familiar with, might truly have evolved. And there might be some kind of possibility that the prosperity of the Lebanon, which has been its major feature, might continue. The other alternative, the one we seem to have embarked on, is a guarantee that the Lebanon will, in not too long a time, become another radical Arab state exactly like Syria. Why? Because the poor Muslim Arabs outnumber the people of the mountain, and because the radical Arab governments are committed to the proposition that all foreign influence, all that is strange, all that is not homogeneous, shall be eradicated. The Arab world shall be one. And what's going to happen if we, once the foreign troops are removed? Each militia will protect its own piece of turf, and finally one will demand something more than the other is willing to give, and the fighting, there will be a renewal of the fighting such as we saw in 75 and 78, and this time the Marines will not return, and this time the radical Arab states, which are the next door neighbors, will move in more forcefully and more directly and with less apology than they had before. If there's any lesson to be learned from the Lebanon, it's this: that we cannot apply to the Middle East those concepts of the nation state, those concepts of government, which apply in the relationships between the United States and Europe and even the Eastern Bloc. The Middle East has never known nation states in the modern form. The Middle East has since time immemorial been a rich collection of what the sociologists call millet communities, self-governing communities whose lives are governed by their own law, by their own traditions, by their own qadis or imams or religious leaders, each one of whom fears everyone else and does what he can to protect himself. The overarching government being responsible simply for foreign affairs, for the larger issues of the state. That's the way the Lebanon was until the end of the 19th century. That's the way Syria and Iraq were well into this century, and they still are, because despite the tyrannical governments in Damascus and Baghdad, both governments are the governments of minority ethnic groups, minority millet communities, tribes, and in time, they will be overthrown. We have to begin to deal, when we deal with the Middle East, with a degree of historic perspective which we don't normally bring to the news, which don't normally bring to the affairs of the world. And the essential asymmetry which plagues Israel is that, for better or for worse, Israel is a modern nation state, operating in a world where those on her borders are politically of a different structure and construction. It's almost impossible to see how Israel can be guaranteed by the Lebanese government the very essential security which she seeks. That's why the impasse. Really, only Israel can guarantee peace in southern Lebanon. There was a United Nations force there. Given the nature of the United Nations, Israel has no faith in the United Nations forces. The terrorists were able to pass through their lines almost at will, and information about Israeli actions was often transmitted back to the terrorists by various members of UNIFIL. Israel has no real feeling that the Italians or the French or the Americans can be trusted to police that part of the world. The Americans went into Beirut, you recall, in September to guarantee the peace of the area. We were to be there for 30 days. We didn't stay there 20. There's already in the Congress noises about the need to limit the number of troops we commit to the Lebanon, and to bring the boys home as quickly as we can. How long would an American force of size effectively patrol that Lebanese area? And if America is not there, can Israel trust the United Nations force? If she can't trust the United Nations force, what other force can she trust? The Lebanese government that can't even protect the American embassy. And there's the puzzlement. And there's the reason that the Israelis are being intransigent and difficult and all those other terms which our newspaper columnists file routinely from the negotiations. What will be the result? I suspect a poor result. I don't think that Israel will stand up too long to American pressure on this issue. It will try and get other guarantees, arms supplies, something of that kind. And they will assume that if they have to, just as they moved into Lebanon 3 years ago and moved into Lebanon last summer, they can move into Lebanon again. That's a non-solution. But that's really the direction that the negotiations seem to be pointing. And the American government, what will we have gained? We seem so determined to prove to the Arab world that we can make Israel do certain things that the Arab world may deem to be appropriate. We've lost our ability to look to what is to our own selfish national interest. To what benefit is it for the United States to see developing in Lebanon another mini radicalized Arab state? The Lebanon, for better or for worse, for all of its weakness, controls a number of the major ports in the Eastern Mediterranean. One of these ports is already a major Soviet base. If more were to become so, our own security, our own ability to protect the oil fields of the Middle East would be markedly weakened. That seems to be the way we're going. It seems to me to be the result of the kind of impulsive, innocent, naive thinking which has governed American policy in the Middle East, at least these last several years. Amen.